Policies issued by American General Life Insurance Company, Houston, Texas. Not available in all states. For details, visit MatrixDirect.com.
Are you willing to pay more for life insurance than you should? Well, did you know some prices on term life insurance have fallen to their lowest rates ever? Hi, I'm Brent Langdon for Matrix Direct. We partnered with American General Life to find you their lowest rates on term life insurance products. So let's say you're 40 years old and married. We could find you a $250,000 policy for less than $14 a month, which means you could save hundreds of dollars a year. Call us now for a free, no-obligation quote. Call 1-800-631-9564. Since 1995, we've helped millions of people find out if they could save up to 75% on their term life insurance. See how much we could save you. It only takes 5 minutes, and you could save up to 75%, and the call is absolutely free. Call 1-800-631-9564. That's 1-800-631-9564.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Hermetic Hour, and I'm your host, Polk Runyon. This is our show for June 3rd, 2010. And the subject tonight is going to be Secrets of the Golden Dawn Cipher Manuscript. And we're going to get into that. And of course, we're going to discuss my book on that. My book and my co-author, Robert Nate Gilbert. We're going to discuss that, but before we get into the subject for tonight, we had a caller last week on our Masonic show about the so-called Masonic conspiracy that we were getting into, and we had a question that was very, very good, and we didn't have a chance to answer it, and so I thought I would carry that over to this week, and we would answer that question, because if I was going to ask a question on the show that we put on, I can't think of a better question to ask than the one that our caller asked. Now, he asked why American Masons and British Masons also, why we do not permit a candidate to be a candidate for Masonry if he has a felony conviction on his record. We will not accept in extraordinary circumstances. We would not approve a man with a felony conviction for membership in Masonry. And he said, what if a man steals a loaf of bread to feed his starving family, would you consider that a reason why he couldn't be a Mason? Well, that's a good question. And it deserves a good answer. One of the things that I pointed out in the show to try to get some understanding of what's behind Masonry and its various manifestations was that British Masonry was where it started, of course, in England, and American Masonry were based primarily on the philosophy of John Locke, British philosopher from the 17th century. And whereas Masonry on the continent, France and Germany and the European countries, that Masonry, even though it was derived from the original British version, it still was much more influenced by the philosophy of Jean Rousseau. And And Jean Rousseau's philosophy was behind the French Revolution, where you might say John Locke's philosophy was behind the American Revolution. And there was a great deal of difference between those two revolutions, and a great deal of difference between the philosophies behind them. So in France and in the continent, the old aristocracy and the power of the church, the power of the nobility, was much more absolute and much more tyrannical than it was in England and, of course, in the United States. So consequently, in France, right before the Revolution, you would be, I think, justified in stealing a loaf of bread to feed your family, because the people were starving, and this was the fault of the government. And so if people are starving and it's absolutely, your family's dying, you're perfectly justified in stealing a loaf of bread. So later, if they want to make that guy a French Mason, fine. That's I have no problem with that. But, and that, of course, Rousseau's philosophy was very radical. Tear it all down, tear the whole establishment down. And that, unfortunately, as we have discovered, that philosophy, as justified as it may be, it leads directly to tyranny. After you tear it all down, you have anarchy, and then tyranny follows. So Rousseau's philosophy led right on through to Hitler and Stalin and various things like that, whereas the John Locke philosophy in England led to Winston Churchill, and then over in America led to Franklin Roosevelt, which is a different kind of government and a different kind of men administering that government. Now, it's true that if conditions are so bad that you have to steal to feed your family, that's not a crime. But the truth is, if that's not the case, then it is a crime. So we feel in England and in the United States, our masonry is based upon the idea that your government is a decent government. If it is a decent government, and if the people are fed, then we don't want criminals. Even though I know some crimes are justified under circumstances, but this is the difference. And I would like to point this out too, along with this, that at the time of Rousseau was promoting his philosophy, and at this time. The Enlightenment was influenced by the idea that all people are born absolutely equal, and that there's no heredity, everybody is born with his brains a blank slate, and his goodness or his badness or his character is entirely formed by his environment, by his parents, his education, and what he has to put up with as he grows up, that influences his entire way of doing things. Well, this has turned out not to be true. In fact, the actual truth is that the so-called lower classes or the working classes are actually, in reality, more moral, more straight-laced and more moral than the upper classes and the rich. So it's poverty does not breed crime, contrary to what some people still believe. People are basically obeying social laws is not a matter of how underprivileged you are when you're young. I know there's still people that disagree with that, but this is pretty much a scientific fact these days. So consequently, in a government that does run a country to where people can support themselves and where nobody actually starves to death, then crime, basic crimes, felonies, are considered to be felonies. And that's the way we look at it in American masonry. That's the way we look at it in British masonry. We are law-abiding, patriotic citizens, and that's it. Whereas I can certainly understand the other extremes over in those tyrannical regimes. That was a different situation. And I think so I'm glad that he asked that question, because that question, you know, really does. It defines the difference between the philosophies behind Continental Masonry and Masonry in England and America. So thanks for that question. I appreciated it. I'm sorry. There's a lot of my personal feeling is that there's a lot of people that have got felony convictions that probably shouldn't have, especially with certain situations in this country where the laws are rather unfair. So, but then again, we have to abide by our policy and the rules, and that's unfortunately the way it is. But the question was good, and I appreciate you bringing it up. Now, let's get on into the subject for tonight, and that is the Cipher Manuscript of the Golden Dawn. Now, most of you probably are aware that I'm the principal author, and I had the honor of having Robert A. Gilbert, who is the world's leading Golden Dawn scholar over in England. He's also the longtime secretary of Credo Coronati, the premier Masonic research lodge in the whole world, and he's been the secretary for quite a while. And he is my co-author in this book. He included a paper on Wynne Westcott and the Society of Eight, which was a Masonic Rosicrucian club from which the cipher manuscript of the Golden Dawn, it emerged. Now, I think we all know that the Golden Dawn, Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which was founded in 1887 in London, that it is the main and primary repository of the formal and practical Western esoteric tradition. It's the great granddaddy of all the magical orders, and including our OTA, and although we use Credo Rapoa initiatory framework, we use all Golden Dawn correspondences. And even the OTO uses Golden Dawn correspondences, even though their rituals are different. However, the Golden Dawn's had a tremendous, tremendous influence on the Western esoteric tradition, on the tarot, on the Hermetic Kabbalah, on our practice of ceremonial magic. The Golden Dawn sets the standard and is the major source. And what is so important about this organization is that it was a very encyclopedic distillation of the Western tradition, and the scholars that created the Golden Dawn, they made the Western tradition practical for meditational and magical and ceremonial use, and they organized the correspondences, got the whole thing together, and made it work. And for this, we owe them a tremendous debt. Now, how this got started was kind of dark and mysterious in a sense, because of various reasons which we'll get into. But anyway, what happened was that the British Masonic Rosicrucian group called the Society of Rosicrucia in Anglia, or the SOCROS, as they're referred to, the SRIA. This was a group back in the 1880s and the late 1870s, 1880s, was a group of British Masons, a Masonic scholar, and occult scholars, who really wanted to create a Rosicrucian, initiatory Rosicrucian tradition. And now, for those of you who don't know about Rosicrucians, I think most of you do, but anyway, the Rosicrucians were, we're never sure whether there really were any real Rosicrucians or not, and this is another one of these mysterious things, that sprang up around about 1600 over in Germany and through Central Europe. These broadsheets began to appear on tacked up on boards that said, "We are the invisible Rosicrucians, and we walk among you, and we have the secrets of the ancients, and we will contact the leaders of your the community, and all of this." And this really got occult scholars and people who were interested in this really excited in Europe. And then some mysterious documents appeared, the Fama Fraternitatis and the Confessio and the Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz. And these mysterious documents appeared, and people were trying to find the Rosicrucians to join them, but they never did. And then, of course, the 30 Years' War came up, and that sort of wiped everything out. The Rosicrucians were a very elusive idea, and we're never really sure whether they ever got together or whether they ever did exist. But after the 30 Years' War, the European and the Masonry got started, both in England and over in the continent, and there was a desire among more mystically inclined Masons to create a Masonic Rosicrucian type series of degrees, or to even have Rosicrucian lodges, and they did. In Germany, they started one called the Ruby Rose and Cross of Gold, and they started it in the 1700s, the late 1700s, and they actually got it going. And so it was based on a Masonic model, regular Masonic-type initiations, but they were Rosicrucian. Now, what Rosicrucians were supposed to do is they were supposed to be experts in Kabbalah and alchemy, and they were supposed to be primarily concerned with healing and with good works, and they were supposed to be mystical Christians. Their Christianity was very eclectic and very mystical, not very dogmatic. But they were supposed to be great scholars and healers and doctors, and they weren't supposed to charge anything. They were supposed to do good works. And so the Germans actually started this lodge. Well, it was very secretive. Now, over in England, about 100 years later, this Rosicrucian or would-be Rosicrucian group got together, these Masons, SRIA, and they had several scholars who were trying to get this thing going. They called themselves the Society of Rosicrucian Anglia, and they wanted to really get a program together, but they couldn't quite manage to do it. But they had a member of this group, Kenneth McKenzie. Now, Kenneth McKenzie was a very very scholarly individual, and he was the author of the Royal Masonic Cyclopedia, which was quite a detailed and authoritative book. And McKenzie decided that he would go over to the continent, over to France and Germany, and he would find the real Rosicrucians. So he went over there, and sure enough, he got himself, because he could speak German and he spoke French and he had these abilities. He managed, as a young man, to get himself into this very secretive German Rosicrucian lodge, the Ruby Rose and Cross of Gold. Well, he got in there, and he actually made notes on their degree system, and he made extensive notes on it. And then he went to France, and he spent some time with Eliphas Levy, who was a French magician who wrote several books on magic, which were very highly thought of by people at that time. Levy was quite a romantic. Levy made up a bunch of stuff, but it was good stuff. I mean, Levy was really considered to be an adept. And so, and Levy, by the way, was the man who really, really put the tarot and the Kabbalah together. Before Levy, the tarot and the Kabbalah were just trying to get together, but Levy actually did it. He actually got the tarot and the Kabbalah together. Well, McKinsey spent some time with Levy, and then he went back to England, and he told his friends at the Society of Rosicrucian Agonies, he said, I've got the degrees. He said, I know what they are. You don't know what they are. I've got them. And, of course, people, you know, were jealous of him, and he wouldn't reveal them. Well, so on this went until McKinsey had a reversal of fortune and was no longer able to afford his coach in foreign. He was, from being a gentleman at leisure, he was now getting to be pretty poor, and he was getting sick. And his wife stuck with him, and she was very much involved in this, too. In fact, her magical name was Cryptonomia, and his was Cryptonomius. And the two of them were getting poorer and poorer, and Kenneth McKenzie was getting sick, and he was getting morose and reclusive and sick. And finally, of course, he passed on. Well, when he passed on, Dr. Wynne Westcott, the coroner for East End London, who was became one of the founders of the Golden Dawn, a major founder of the Golden Dawn with McGregor Mathers. Westcott was a member of this SRIA. And so Westcott went right over to Alexandrina McKinsey's house, the poor widow, and Kenneth was hardly even stiff yet. And Westcott comes in and says, can we have his papers? And the poor woman just gave Westcott a big cardboard box full of Kenneth's papers. Well, we're not absolutely sure, but we think, both Bob Gilbert and myself, that in that box, along with a lot of other stuff, in that box was the 57-page cipher manuscript, which eventually became the cipher manuscript of the Golden Dawn. These were the continental degrees which McKinsey, possibly with Frederick Hockley's help, had converted into a British system. Now, it's important that we note this, this wasn't just a straight German degrees. This was a British version of the German degrees. And what McKinsey had done was he had written this out, and then he or somebody working for him had put this into cipher, into code characters. Now, the cipher that they used was an alchemical cipher from Abbot Trithemius back around 1610 or something like that. And Trithemius had come up with a lot of ciphers. He had a lot of different ciphers. He was, along with being a magical scholar, Abbot Trithemius, one of the major magical scholars, he was also a cryptographer, and he had several different codes. This was one of them. This was an alchemical cipher he had created. So they used that, and they put this synthesized German and British system into these cipher characters. So we had 57 pages of enciphered rituals and knowledge lectures. Now, that the cipher manuscript deciphers into English, so we know that it was Englished, and you can tell as you go through it that English references are made, and yet it still draws on the continental sources. There's no doubt about that. Now, McKinsey also, in order to make it look older than it was, he did it on paper. He must have had a half a ream of old paper from about 70 years earlier. So he put it, and he did it in brown ink, and he made it look like it was older, which was pretty common in those days. Now, you know, you understand that McKinsey did not want, when he presented this thing, of course he died before it was ever presented, but when he presented this thing, he did not want to say, I wrote it. He wanted to indicate that it was written by someone earlier who had already passed away. That's the way they did things in those days. If McKinsey had said, okay, I wrote this, then his colleagues would have said, ooh, you wrote it. Oh, well, what can, well, we don't agree with you. And what do you think you know? And all of that kind of stuff. So even though they knew that he'd been over there, and even though they knew that he had, you know, he'd been with the German Rosicrucians, they still, if he said he'd written it, they never would have accepted it. So he wrote it in old style. Well, magic books are done this way. Lots of magic books, in fact, most of them, as a matter of fact, are attributed to somebody else. So this is a common thing. Now, just let's point something out here for those of you who think that oh my gosh, if McKinsey, you know, faked it and all of this, that means it isn't worth anything. No. The Zohar itself was a hoax. And the reason why I say that is that Boyce de Leon, who published the Zohar back in 1360, claimed that it was from an Aramaic manuscript from the 2nd century A.D. Well, when Marshall de Leon died, a very wealthy rabbi went over to his house and talked to his widow, his daughter, and said, gee, you know, he said, I know you're both miserably poor right now. I'll buy that manuscript, that Aramaic manuscript from you, and I'll pay you enough to where you both can you know, get out of debt and live well and whatever, because I really want that Aramaic manuscript. And both the wife and the daughter said, oh, Daddy made it up. So here's the great Zohar itself was somewhat similar to the Golden Dawn Cypher manuscript in that respect. Now, I'm not trying to say the Cypher manuscript is as important as the Zohar, but yeah, it's the same kind of thing. So here was this thing, and Westcott had it. He got in the box. He got home with the box, and he looked in the box, and oh, my gosh, here it is. And he's got it. So he calls up Mathers on the telephone. They had them in those days. And he said, Sam, get over here right away. I've got it. So between Sam Mathers and Westcott, they looked at this and they said, this is what we need. But how are they going to explain it to everybody, and what are they going to do? They get to get this Rosicrucian group started that they all wanted to start. So they had to have some kind of a story. They couldn't say, well, we just got it out of a box of McKinsey's papers. Now, people would, the jealousies and the nitpicking that would go on if they said that, they'd never get it off the ground. So even, you know, even McKinsey would not have claimed authorship for it. So they decided they would create a kind of a hoax. And they made sure, though, that when they created the hoax, that the hoax was not too far from the actual truth. So what they did was they created a 90-year-old German woman called Fräulein Sprengel, who would have sent them the manuscript. And then, no sooner had she authorized them to do something with it, you know, indicating, of course, giving the impression that she was a member of the Ruby Rose Cross Gold, and no sooner would she get it to them than she would conveniently die, and then communication would be broken, and they would have it, and they would be off and running. Now, that's what they decided to do, and so Westcott had some letters written from a post in Germany and had it set over it, and they created this little thing. But interestingly enough, when they created this hoax, they gave Fräulein Springel, they gave her a magical motto, Sapiens Dominubitur Astris. SDA, okay, but here's the catch on that. We just recently found out, just in the past few years, we just recently found out that that happened to be the motto of a very, very famous and very, very respected British occult lady, occult scholar, Dr. Anna Kingsford. Now, Dr. Anna Kingsford had been the head of theosophy in England, and of course, she'd gotten out of theosophy when during the Krishnamurti scandal, she got out of theosophy, and she really was more Western-oriented, so she started a group called the Hermetic Society, which both Westcott and Mathers were members of, and they were lecturing at her Hermetic Society. Well, Anna Kingsford had just died that year, and that was her magical motto. Bob Gilbert just found out about this just a very short time ago, because she had delivered a paper over in Austria under that motto. So what they were really saying was that they were kind of underneath saying that Anna Kingsford was supporting them. And then also Alexandrina McKenzie, they initiated McKenzie's widow. She was one of the first initiates that they took into the Golden Dawn. So the mysterious Fräulein Springel was really a composite of Anna Kingsford and Alexandrina McKenzie. They weren't really lying that much. And also, too, we might mention that the Verge Springel has been alleged by some people to be a Masonic joke in German at the time. Springel was a sort of a something phony in German masonry, and so they were sort of had their tongue in their cheeks when they did this. So they weren't really pulling a hoax that hurt anybody, and they used that as their charter myth, if you will. And so the Golden Dawn was founded, and off it went. Well. Now, you know, we're talking about a cipher manuscript. We should really kind of talk about what it is. It's a 57-page cryptogram on these cipher characters, which translates into English. Now, it's not just ritual outlines. It's also knowledge lectures. And the Golden Dawn is these knowledge lectures, plus all of the material embedded in the rituals, represents a terrific synthesis of the material of Cornelius Agrippa, of Trithemius. This takes the Western esoteric tradition, the magical tradition, and the alchemical tradition, and the Kabbalah, which, because a lot of this is based on Knorr von Rosenroth's Kabbalah Denudata, which was the only translation of the Zohar that was available to those who did not read the original Hebrew at that time. And the Hebrew Ash Masoreth was the only text that combined alchemy and Kabbalah. And then we had Eliphas Levi's version of the tarot, which really made a small change on it. One of the things that the Golden Dawn did that was remarkable, and it was that they had their version of the correspondences of the four elements, the signs of the zodiac, and the planets attributed to the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, according to the original book of the Kabbalah, the Sefer Yetzirah. All of this was laid out in such a way that it would all go on the Tree of Life diagram and be a complete integrated system, integrated with the Tarot, the Kabbalah, and alchemy, and the whole thing would be completely integrated for practical work. this was really, really amazing. And they had to do a lot of sorting through and a lot of deep meditation. They had to have a tremendous knowledge of the Bible, the Kabbalah, and even Eastern mysticism, which they included. And they created a system that was totally interlocked and completely practical. And not only that, they integrated the Enochian system of Dee and Kelly from back in Elizabeth's time, this tremendous Enochian system of magic, and they integrated that into it. And this whole, they created a whole magical universe that you could have practical access to. And this was an amazing thing. It was just amazing. Now, the cipher manuscript itself, as I said, it's 57 pages. What I did, I got my copy from Rigardi via David Kennedy, who was one of Rigardi's proteges. And back when we started Isis Osiris in 1980, that was from 1980 to 1986. We ran the Isis Osiris Temple of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, Pasadena, and so we had the cipher manuscript from Rigardi, and I started working on it. David tried to decipher it, and he couldn't quite manage it, so I started. But the copy wasn't all that good, and so then as things moved along, I got a much better copy from Lionel Snell over over in England, and eventually I got and then I got in touch with Bob Gilbert finally, and got this thing together, and Bob Gilbert offered to contribute his article on the Society of Eight, which was the clique, the Sockross clique that all these people belong to. So you really understand the politics and the personal politics behind all this stuff. And so we put together this book, and right now we have the second edition. And what I decided to do, the first edition came out in 97, and that's been selling ever since. And so, and that was paperback, and so what I decided to do, when we got the new material on Anna Kingsford, I added that, and then I added something on the Horus Affair, which I'll read for you, because that's where the Anna Kingsford thing sort of came back to bite them in the end. And we added all of this to the new second edition. Now, the new second edition is a beautiful hardback. It's in pebble grain blue leatherette with gold stamp, Golden Dawn logo on the cover, Secrets of the Golden Dawn cipher manuscript in gold, and all the new material in it. And you can get this, it's on Amazon right now. You can get it for $39.95 on Amazon. The old paperback's no longer in circulation. However, I just saw they added eBay for one of the old paperbacks, the 97 paperbacks. somebody wants $250 for this thing, and they're selling it in England for $200. And then other people are selling it for $100. This is the paperback. But the new second edition is so much. It's got all the new material in it, this beautiful hardback. So, and that's we're not making any money on this one, because this at 40 bucks a copy, we're just breaking even. But this is a beautiful book, and so if you want a copy of the cipher manuscript with all the new material, for heaven's sake, get the new second edition. You'll find it on Amazon anyway. The Horus Affair is something we need to discuss, because this business of Anna Kingsford's motto came back and was used to deceive Mathers, and this almost destroyed the Golden Dawn. So let me read a little bit of this to you. Years later, in the period leading up to the Horus scandal, Mathers openly accused Westcott of having forged or procured to be forged his communication with the secret chief, so that was the sprinkle. And Dr. Westcott had resigned from the order a few years earlier when his association with esotericism had begun to threaten his professional medical standing. And on trying to keep his esoteric interests from intruding further into his career, he denied Mather's accusation, but declined to protest, saying only that all his witnesses to the contrary were deceased. And this brings us to the Horus affair. The Imperator of the Golden Dawn, Samuel McGregor Mathers, and his wife were shamefully exploited by a fraudulent spiritualist medium, Madame Horus, who then went on to create a bogus Golden Dawn in 1901. Now, this perverse charade ended in a scandal that nearly destroyed the genuine order through collateral damage in the popular press. Again, the bare facts as stated are true, but behind these facts lies a strange story that would make an intriguing plot for a Sherlock Holmes adventure. Now, Samuel Mathers and his wife, Moina, sister of the philosopher Henry Bergson, had relocated from London to Paris in 1892. And there they founded and operated the Athur Temple of the GD, while still trying to exercise control over the British temples. Now, Dr. Woodman had died, and Wynne Westcott had resigned, for reasons already stated, leaving McGregor Mathers as the last of the founding adepti. He now claimed to be in contact with the secret chiefs of the exalted Third Order. And he was thus entitled to absolute power over the affairs of the GD and the RRNAC, that's the Inner Order. Now, this was not what was originally intended in the Golden John's chartering documents, and it was the first step in a chain of events that would end in disaster. Now, before we follow this sequence further, let's stop to consider another 19th century and early 20th century psychic phenomenon that preceded and set the stage for Madame Blavatsky's ascended masters, the American export, spiritualism. Now, there are still millions of people today who firmly believe that spiritualist mediums can contact the recent dead. Fortunately, by the 21st century, most intelligent, well-educated people have learned to be skeptical about this activity. But at the turn of the last century, spiritualist mediums were taken very seriously by a number of important people, among them the creator of Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle. So let us not look back with bemused contempt upon the victims of these fraudulent mediums. These gaff seances may seem obviously fake to us now, but in those days they were the state-of-the-art productions, and for professional swindlers, it was a big business. For those who wish to investigate this further, we suggest The Psychic Mafia by Lamar Keene and various accounts of spiritual skullduggery exposed by Harry Houdini. Now, in 1900, one of the most talented and prolific of the professional con artists using spiritualism and occultism as an M.O. was a huge, imposing, and powerfully charismatic woman who called herself the Swami, or Madame Horus. Now, returning to the Victorian era in our mind's eye, we might imagine Dr. John Watson asking his famous colleague, "I say, Holmes, do you really believe that horrible Horus woman was actually in contact with the spirits?" And with a sly look and a wry smile, Holmes would reply, "Elementals, my dear Watson." Now, keeping Holmes' deduction in mind, let us again take up the thread of our tale. And early in the year 1900, Mathers and his wife were visited by an extraordinary trio. Madame Horus, her husband Theo, and Dr. Rose Adams, newly arrived from the United States, bearing a local recommendation from one of Mathers' influential Parisian friends, and bona fides from the American M.A. Temple of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, founded under Mathers' own warrant some years previous. Not only were their credentials impeccable, but Madame Horus herself displayed a knowledge of secret grade signs, passwords, and order teachings sufficient to convince Mathers that she was a Rosicrucian adept of his own tradition. Well, after gaining his confidence with her carefully researched cover story, she set the hook by revealing to him in a mediumistic state the details of a private conversation he had once had with the late Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, whose spirit Madame Horos claimed she embodied. With the hook now firmly set, she went on to channel the secret chief, or more properly, the secret chieftainess, of the order. In this case, the mysterious Sapiens Dominibitur Astris, SDA, whom Westcott had fictionalized as Fräulein Sprengel. And she also convinced Mathers of this contact, and he introduced Madame Horos to his Parisian temple members under the SDA motto. And, of course, Anna Kingsford, the original SDA, had died in 1888. Now, as embarrassing and eventually devastating as her deception proved to be, it is to Mather's credit that he never issued Madame Horos a charter or a letter of authorization. However, he did loan her a neophyte 0=0 ritual, which she did not return. Mathers soon realized that he had been deceived, and he declared Madame Horos and her people persona non grata, but the damage, unfortunately, had already been done. After her Paris-France escapade, Madame Horos, whose real name was Editha Solomon Jackson, spent a year fleecing the marks in Cape Town, South Africa, with a highly publicized and briefly successful occult scam. When the Cape Town Bunko Squad made things too hot for them, the Swami and her entourage decamped for London, where they set up a secret temple to initiate prospective dupes into what was alleged to be the Golden Dawn. They pursued this course for several months until the Swami's husband, Frank Jackson, a.k.a. Theo Horos, was arrested for statutory rape. Madame Horos was also charged for aiding and abetting the same offense. The 16-year-old girl victim testified in court that the Horos couple had subjected her to this felonious indignity as part of her initiation into the Golden Dawn. The London press had a field day with a ritual at the trial, and it was soon determined that the Horos operation was not the real Golden Dawn. But in the course of establishing this, the authentic Golden Dawn had to shed its cloak of secrecy and stand naked in the glaring light of the worst publicity possible. And to make matters worse, the oath of obligation taken from the stolen neophyte script was published in the London newspapers with derogatory comments. At this point, many members of the regular Golden Dawn temples quietly resigned, and the sad event set in motion a series of reorganizations, restructuring, and revisions throughout the network of surviving Golden Dawn temples. The name Golden Dawn was changed in Britain to Stella Matutina. Over in France, Mathers Temple became known as the Alpha and Omega. The Golden Dawn Rosicrucians had been hurt and humiliated, but they survived on the merits of their work and no longer depending upon the Sprengel Charter myth or the infallibility of autocratic leaders invoking secret chiefs under new leadership. In England, in France, in America, and in New Zealand, the order continued its work in one or another of its various forms and venues from the turn of the century to the present day. And it remains the epitome of Western esoteric ritual and practice. No other Rosicrucian order initiates its candidates on the cross of obligation and conducts its rites inside a replica of the tomb of Christian Rosenkreuz. The ruby rose at Ori Crucis, the inner order of the Golden Dawn, is thus the truest and most authentic of all Rosicrucian orders. Which brings us to the last of our major complaints concerning the Golden Dawn and its alleged connection with the libertine Gnostic philosophy and the practices of Aleister Crowley's Thelemic sect. Now, how can an order that claims to be Rosicrucian also be connected with an iconoclastic and apparently anti-Judeo-Christian faction following the tenets of Crowley's Liberal Del Legis, the Book of the Law? Well, the answer is, it cannot and it does not. The Golden Dawn is not Thelemic. And even if an attempt to create a Thelemic Golden Dawn were to be successful, it would still be a philosophical oxymoron. It is not my purpose to denigrate Crowley or his philosophy or his followers. They get all the criticism they need from my esteemed colleagues. In Crowley's defense, I will say that he really was not the wickedest man in the world, however much he enjoyed that label in the tabloid press, but he might have actually aspired to the title of the world's naughtiest man. By that, be that as it may, there are three reasons why Aleister Crowley has been linked to the Golden Dawn and why some people believe that the Golden Dawn is linked with Crowley. First, Crowley joined the Golden Dawn in 1898 at the age of 23. He went through all the outer order grades, but he was refused entrance to the inner order, the RODC, in London. He was subsequently initiated as an Adeptus Minor by MacGregor Mathers in Paris in 1900, so he certainly was a member. But then we must recall that neither Adolf Hitler or Al Capone were ever excommunicated from the Roman Catholic Church, whereas Crowley was certainly declared persona non grata of the Golden Dawn, not only by William Butler Yeats in London, but later by his mentor Mathers in Paris. About Crowley's association with the Golden Dawn, Eli Howe himself states that his prominence was brief and his influence minimal. Secondly, Crowley appropriated and published Golden Dawn papers in his periodical The Equinox and subsequently used GD materials in his own order, the Argentum Astrum. It is true, this is true, but MacGregor Mathers took him to court on this case, and Crowley also revised GD materials that he lifted to conform with the tenets of his 1904 Revelatory Book of the Law. Now, third, the psychedelic and sexual liberation era of the middle 1960s and early 1970s brought about a revival of Crowley's works and a spate of books about him. This popular focus on Crowley and the more sensational aspects of his philosophy, in effect the use of drugs and sex, tended to connect his early Golden Dawn period with his later, more controversial views and activities. Now, making this brief GD connection seem even more important, Crowley's former secretary, Israel Righardi, who was himself a former Golden Dawn member, had published the largest collection of GD material up to that time, became the leading author promoting Crowley's revival in the 1970s. And even though the philosophies, methods, and rituals and aspirations of Crowley's Ordo Templi Orientis and the original Golden Dawn are significantly different in almost every respect, Righardi tended to blur these disparities in an intellectual smorgasbord of exotic offerings in print. If the truth be known, to use one of Righardi's favorite expressions, Crowley's Aeon of Horus, the new era of the crowned and conquering child, is a specific and obvious rebellion against the Golden Dawn's Osirian, Rosicrucian, and biblical ethos. Therefore, to make the Golden Dawn polemic, you would literally have to turn its philosophy upside down. There is no appeal to sexual liberation, social radicalism, or ecstatic shamanism in any Golden Dawn ritual. In fact, the exact opposite is true. However justifiable the polemic spiritual revival against repressive Victorian biblical morality may or may not have been, the Golden Dawn was certainly not a party to it. In actual fact, the Golden Dawn was one of the primary targets of Crowley's polemic rebellion. Now, you know, I had to say to write this, and it is true, all of it, and to write it, because this paper was presented to a Masonic audience, and they were at the time really, really going after Crowley and everybody, and the Golden Dawn too. So consequently, I had to set them straight on this. I'm not that mad at the OTO, and I'm not that mad at Crowley, but we have to point out that it really is a different philosophy. I know somebody tried to start a polemic Golden Dawn, but now it really wouldn't work philosophically because they really are totally different. Anyway, the cipher manuscript of the Golden Dawn is a fascinating excursion into the background of the Golden Dawn. You might want to say, in a way, that if you really want to understand the Golden Dawn and understand the core of its teaching, it comes from the cipher manuscript. This is a very detailed work, and you can take any page of the cipher manuscript represents, I would say, the teachings in two or three, if not four or five books that go into putting this thing together. It really is the core of the practical Western tradition. And the way they arranged the tarot and the way they compared everything, the very alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet, 22 letters, and the way they're applied to the signs of the zodiac, the planets and the elements, this in itself is a treasure. And don't think for one minute that all the Sefer Yetzirah, all Sefer Yetzirahs make these assignments, but they're all different. The Golden Dawn arranged them in a manner that all fits together. And this means that the Golden Dawn's version of the attributes of the Hebrew alphabet are the most magical and the best magical system that you could possibly have in connection with the Western esoteric tradition. And you might say that if you took Cornelius Agrippa's three books, including the fourth one that we're not sure Agrippa did, but you take this and you take the Key of Solomon and all of the magic books and put them all together, then you would have and really, really get them to all fit and get them to fit together in a system that really, really works. Then you would really appreciate the work that went into this 57-page cipher manuscript. Now, obviously, I'm trying to encourage you to get the book, but frankly, if you want to understand the Golden Dawn, you want to understand the mainstream origins of Western magic, this really is a book you ought to have. And what I've done is I've gone through, there are other versions, by the way, of the cipher manuscript available, but what I've done is I've footnoted. I've got quite extensive footnotes on every page, and I've got commentary and analysis on the cipher manuscript. The other cipher manuscript books do not have that. They just have a translation, and they have the manuscript, and they have a translation, and that's it. And you really, really need to know where all this comes from and what it all means. And so ours is the only book on the cipher manuscript that really tells you what it's all about and where it comes from and gives you all of the notes surrounding virtually everything in it. And you get through this book, and then we have in the back we have a study guide where all the source material is laid out and how you should approach studying. And then we also have a very interesting essay on the 11-sphere tree, which figured in the inner order. And the 11-sphere tree is one of the keys to high magic. And this is something that other books on the cipher manuscript, they don't even discuss it. And yet the 11-sphere tree is definitely a part of the cipher manuscript. But you don't get any discussion about what the secrets of it really are. So consequently, when we say this is Secrets of the Golden Dawn cipher manuscript, we mean exactly that. This gives you the inside on it. Now, next week, we will continue. We'll be back on station. And next week, we're going to be going into detail on this, we're going to deal with the Enochian system. Next week, we are going to discuss Enochian magic and both Golden Dawn and the depurist school and some of the newest developments in that. Be sure and tune in, and we will get into one of the fascinating subjects, the origin and the practice of Enochian magic. So, until then, good magic, and we'll see you next week.